Make the choice to begin anywhere in your life, and the journey has started.
We exist more than just to educate. We exist to also revitalize.
And along the way, you can inspire others and be inspired.
But now there's a new generation of scholars, and I am among them.
If you really want to know who you are and what you are capable of, Howard is the choice for you.
Take a moment. Listen to the stories by joining the president of Howard University, Dr. Wayne A.I. Frederick, and his guest on The Journey.
There are broad misconceptions about how African Americans give and whether or not they even give. The most recent survey of consumer finances produced by the Federal Reserve Bank makes it clear that despite the institutional barriers that block access to capital and wealth creation, Black families prioritize philanthropy. In alignment with our Howard Forward strategic plan, it is our mission to deliver on the promise of our five strategic pillars, especially the one on financial stability. By enhancing philanthropic support and alumni engagement for the university, he is selling our mission. The return on investment is a world influenced by Howard's best and brightest students and ultimately the best and brightest alum in the workforce, a world we all will want to and would cherish living in. Hello, I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick, and my guest today on The Journey is the Vice President for Development and Alumni Relations, David Bennett. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So you grew up in Omaha, Nebraska.
I did.
Tell me a little bit about what that was like before moving to one of my favorite places in all the world, Storrs, Connecticut.
So we grew up in Omaha in a very middle-class family home. My parents, my mother was able to be at home for most of my youth, my two older brothers. And Omaha at the time was a city of already 300,000 people. It was not the kind of small town people thought. But when I moved with my family to a very small town between Hartford and Providence, about 8,000 people in the summer, everybody asked me how big my farm was and how much cattle we had and the rest. It was a great experience for me because I think I'm very Midwestern in a lot of my values and how I think about other people, but definitely have an East Coast touch in terms of style and how I speak and what I got to see as a kid.
And what prompted the move to Storrs, Connecticut?
So I'm unusual. I'm one of the few people in my profession that's second generation. So my father was a university fundraiser and was at the University of Nebraska in Omaha when I was young, and then moved to become the first vice president for development at the University of Connecticut. And then they continued on after I grew up to Oklahoma and a couple of other places.
So does that mean that he took you to the fundraising events, the dinners, the so on? Or, I mean, what was your exposure? When did you first really realize what he did and what exactly the mechanics of it looked like?
So when I was at UConn as a kid, that's when Big East basketball was really what it was all about. So I got to sit at midcourt or midfield if I would wear a blazer and go to the alumni brunch beforehand or the cocktail party afterwards. And I will say, whenever I see your son with you, it's very reminiscent of that experience I had. Now, I've learned that my dad just wanted to leave the brunch as quickly as possible, which he used me as an excuse, where I think you just love bringing Wayne out to see those things. But I think early on, I understood that my dad wasn't an academic, but he made the work of other academics and students and researchers possible.
So, you know, obviously growing up in the Midwest and on the East Coast, but primarily in around academics, what did your parents instill in you as far as where education played a role, and what was your journey in terms of at least your academic life?
So my parents were both the first generation to go to college. And growing up in college environments, my high school was probably 90% connected to the university. Now, you might have been the president's son or the janitor's daughter, but that connection to the university and education was something that just, we didn't even talk about. It was just in the air and in the atmosphere around us. So my brothers and I joke, it never occurred to us that we had that there was another option other than applying to college after school. Now, where we could go and what was the right match and what we could afford, those were all questions. But that we were going to college was never a conversation that we had, because it just was.
Right. And in terms of your elementary and middle school experience as a result, all the way through high school, was it different? Because I would imagine if your parents were around an academic environment and if they themselves were college educated, what they may have exposed you to may have looked different as well.
We were very blessed in that regard, particularly at high school. The high school I attended used to be the lab school for the university. I think my senior year, three of my high school teachers had PhDs in their field. It was a very, and it was a public school. It was available to everyone in the community. It was the only school for about 15 miles around. We were just very fortunate that the exposure was there. Now, I also, in retrospect, am mindful of the fact that we drilled vocabulary words and analogies and basic algebra every week for probably 7 or 8 years of my education. So when it came to things like SATs and Blue Book exams in college, those weren't intimidating because, frankly, we'd done them once a week for probably 200 or 300 weeks. Being at Howard and learning more about the differences in exposure, when you talk about things like SAT scores and averages and preparation for college, I even better understand now how blessed I was with the environment that we were brought up in.
And I guess keeping along that vein, when you did decide on your college choices, what were the factors that came into your mind in terms of the choice that you made? And you could tell our listeners as well about your alma mater.
So I ended up attending the University of Virginia, and I think there were three or four factors that were important to me. The first was I wanted to be far enough away from home that my parents couldn't come every weekend, but distant enough, not too far away, that it still I could get home for Thanksgiving and maybe to do my laundry at Christmas. I think size was important for me, that the large state schools that I had grown up near seemed impersonal and seemed distant. But I didn't want to go to a little liberal arts college where you were never going to meet someone new or be pushed or find a professor or a class you didn't know about. So when I went to UVA, it was very similar in size to what Howard is now. It was about 9,500, 10,000 undergraduate students, two-thirds from Virginia, but Virginia being such a hugely diverse state, and then a third of us from other places, country states. When I visited the history, the legacy, the context that is that institution was very attractive and appealing. Again, the lawn at the UVA having a similar legacy and history as the yard does here. Now, again, with the benefit of time and history, understanding that those legacies are, in fact, very, very different, but the idea that place was important, that there was an anchor, appealed to me more than going to an urban school, for example.
You're listening to The Journey. My guest today is David Bennett, the Vice President for Development and Alumni Relations here at Howard University. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. So to switch gears a bit, you then graduate from UVA. How does one get into a fundraising role? I'm often curious about that journey and that path. What led you into that experience?
So I'm a little unusual because my parents made it clear that we all had to pay for at least a semester of our education. They wanted us to have some skin in the game. And so I worked my way through school, either as a resident assistant, but then because of my background, worked the student telecenter in the Springs. And so through that, got known to people and got involved with the university that way. When I left college, there were two things I didn't want to do: be a fundraiser or work in politics. And about 6 weeks later, I was a campaign fundraiser working in national politics. I think for me, it became deliberate very quickly. Because it's, again, a very unusual opportunity for me to be able to be a bridge between people who have the capacity to change the world and people who have the resources to make it happen. And for me, it's always been a very natural expression of how to live my values by enabling others to make them happen. A lot of us get in through college or university or through volunteering. There's a disease charity that's important to you. There's an alma mater, an alumni association that's important. But mine was oddly accidental for someone who grew up doing it.
So from politics, what was your real first focused fundraising job?
So after politics, I went to a consulting firm that had placed me on my last campaign who wanted to get out of politics. This increasing division in the party meant people who'd done it for 30 years no longer found the joy and the energy in it, and they wanted to go somewhere else. So my job was to take them out of political fundraising and traditional fundraising. So two or three of the first things that we did for the Smithsonian's 125th anniversary, they wanted to do a national tour of key artifacts. They raised about half the money and hit the wall. And so they brought brought us in to find the rest of the money to take everything from Abraham Lincoln's hat to Kermit the Frog across the country so the Smithsonian could become accessible to people. And then we created the first endowment fund for the MD Anderson Cancer Center at the University of Texas, which I know is important to you, which has become a huge important factor in their innovation. And last was a $125 million campaign to build a science center in New Jersey that particularly focused on free access for students in underserved and urban school districts in the state. It's the biggest, newest science center in America at the time.
So what about fundraising you think is the most challenging? And obviously you've kind of laid out what's rewarding about it, but what's most challenging about it? And what do you think that people intuitively don't recognize makes that challenge even that much more of a challenge?
I think there are two. I think on one end of the giving spectrum, it's really hard to let people know that their $10 makes a difference. And when we see this era of $1 million and multi-million dollar gifts, it's really hard, and I get the question from Howard alums all the time, how does my $10 make a difference? Well, your $10 a month, along with three of the women that lived on your floor in Truth, buys books for a student this semester. And a lot of our alums can look back and say, you know, I struggle to buy books one semester as well. So is a $10 a month gift going to, you know, build a brand new communications building? No. But can it change the life of a student? Yes. That's hard to explain. At the higher end, it's cutting through the clutter. Because a lot of people may not know Howard or may have misperceptions or limited perceptions of Howard. And so it's getting into the place where you or a trustee or I have the chance to say, no, let me show you what Howard is. Let me help you understand the quality of our kids, that we're not a school whose best work was 50 years ago. We're a school whose best work ever is today, and we're just getting better along the way.
And your last couple of stops were at the chief advancement as the chief advancement officer at Safe Kids and then at National Geographic. What about those two jobs you think prepared you for this job at Howard University?
I think Safe Kids was interesting because I managed communications, marketing, public affairs, and development. And that's too big a job for any one person to have at Howard, but I think I have an appreciation and understanding for what those mean. And when we look at the federal appropriation and social media platforms and things like that, I'm not as good as my colleagues are at that, but I think I can understand and support and see how the pieces fit together. National Geographic was a global job. I did about 200,000 miles a year. I got to work with all kinds of different people, literally in countries and continents around the world. And I think in a different way, the diversity of experience that is Howard, the breadth of the portfolio, what happens from African-American studies to the stigma program to capital needs, it's such a huge portfolio. I think that's been made it coming to Howard exciting for me rather than more challenging.
Now, one of my visions is to ensure that as we build our development program and obviously get into a capital campaign, that one of the secondary agendas is that we create a pipeline of fundraisers who are African-American because of the lack of representation. How realistic do you see us trying to really fill that pipeline?
I think it's going to be hard, but I think it's one of the most exciting parts of the job, because it's one thing if you're at a National Geographic and are highly resourced and can throw money around and get the best people regardless of what they look like. Here, we're going to be building people. We're going to be creating the next generation of professionals and doing it in a way that fundraisers of color, particularly African-American fundraisers, can say, gosh, this is a place where I can fail, I can take risks, I can learn, I'll be given challenges and support, but also held to the highest expectations.
Right. And as you go out and make the argument to obviously have folks give to the university and have them really look at us as a philanthropic opportunity, why Howard University?
Because if you believe in the promise of America, if you believe in the idea of a more perfect union, we can also say at the same time, we're not there. And if our Howard history shows anything, it's the journey is accelerated. We go faster on the road to justice. If Howard women and Howard men are in front of the judge, in the surgical suite, in the classroom, in the community, on the picket lines, and I think investments in Howard, in our students, in our researchers, in our faculty, provide a return on investment higher than you'll find at any other university in America.
Thanks for being here. My guest today has been David Bennett, our Vice President for Development and Alumni Relations. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. Please join me next time on The Journey.